Hello, everybody, and welcome to the LFC Red Poets podcast. Tonight, we're hosting a special. We look back on the 40th anniversary of the first All Merseyside Cup final at Wembley, when Liverpool met Everton in the League Cup final on the 25th of March 1984. I'm your host, Les Lawson, and I'm joined tonight, as usual, by Tom Keegan and Pete Warburton, and special guest, Tony Evans, top journalist. We were hoping to be also joined tonight by Elton Wellesby, but he's got technical difficulties, and unfortunately he's having trouble logging on to the podcast. So what we'll do, where we'll start with this one, is I'll ask people what they were doing 40 years ago today in 1984, so people can get a flavour of how times have changed. I, for example, I was just coming up to my 21st birthday. I was on a community programme scheme, and for people who don't know what that was like an invention by the Tories to try and manipulate the unemployment figures, where you were put on a scheme for a year, earning a little bit more than what you would get on the dole, but nowhere near what you should have got if you're working properly. And I was working for West Everton Age Concern, and I was a payroll clerk. I was a season ticket holder at the match, and also sold tickets for the Liverpool Development Association. So I'll move on to Pete. What were you doing in 1984, Pete?
I was a single lad still living at home. So I was spending most of my money watching Liverpool home and away, to be honest. Like you, I had the season tickets. Tried to get to as many games as could away, if possible. And I had a decent life, really. I'd just go home, get me tea off my mum. She'd do all my ironing for me. And then I'd just say, yeah, I'm going to Sunderland at the weekend, so I mightn't be back till Monday. My mate had relatives, so things like that. I'd just go away for the weekend with Liverpool, to be honest. I had a car, so we'd travel to Ipswich and far-flung places and sleep in the car overnight. Just me and my mates used to do things that, you know, single lads do, just travel away, really, watching in the Reds, watching all the home games. And then I think it was the summer of that year, it wasn't until the summer that I met my now wife in 84. So, as I say, I was still single, not really having to answer to anyone apart from my mum. And I tipped her with my money, and she didn't care after that, as long as I tipped my money to her, you know.
Tom, what was a young Thomas Keegan doing?
Oh my God.
Back in the 1984.
Les, I come from a very. So got married at 18. Had a young boy. Got a job in Dunlop's in Speke in 1974. Got a quickly stayed in Dunlop's until 78, until it was made. They were made unemployment. Had a stayed for the extra year with 195 other people. Went picketing down on Fort Dunlop as a flying picket in 1979. And then come out in, by 1979, I had another son. And then I got into 81, we couldn't get a job. And then 81, I ended up enrolling for a chiropody course in 1981. And I was coming towards the end of the course to become a chiropodist, and that's where I ended up. But 90, I was a season ticket holder. I was mad season ticket holder. Used to go to all the games with all me nutty friends from Speak. And we used to travel to away with Lenny Ryan. We used to travel home and away. And that was where we were up to.
Tony, so what were you doing then in the halcyon days of 1984?
I was Liverpool ordinary, Yankee bar on the ale, 42ers. I was working in town in OE McIntyre's, the dodgiest place in town, and I was a member of the farm. So I was playing gigs around the country when I wasn't going to match, and often we used to play places to coincide with going to games, which didn't really have a great impact on our musical abilities because clearly we'd been on the ale all day. But like, but yeah, the match was the most important thing at the time. And obviously the political circumstances meant that it wasn't just about going the match. It was about the idea of our sense of selves, our culture, and our opposition to what was happening in the country and the Tory government. So I was, I still describe myself as a Liverpool militant. And for the rest of my life, I'll be militant and I'll be angry. And you know what? I was an angry 23-year-old in those days. And, good days, but you know what? We were fighting, and unfortunately, we have to have the same fight now, 40 years on.
Yeah, Tony, it's fair to say, isn't it, that Liverpool was a very, very different city back then than it is now. You know, mass unemployment, you know, the Tory government led by Thatcher was basically trying to mothball the city. She didn't want to give us any money. She basically wanted Liverpool not to exist. And, you know, there was the Labour Council led by Derek Hatton, who set an illegal budget and took on, you know, the Thatcher government and had the backing of the whole of the Liverpool people.
I mean, the only thing I'd argue about there is that it was led by Derek Hatton. It was actually the man who was the intellectual sort of powerhouse behind that government, behind the council, was Tony Benn. And what the council did actually was what Thatcherism advised you to do, take out a mortgage and buy a house. So what they did is there was rate capping. And the Tory government was withdrawing money from not just Liverpool, but from every city and trying to stop, you know, trying to squeeze cities on jobs and services. And Liverpool said no. And Tony Benn went to the Swiss banks and basically took out a mortgage to build houses in Liverpool, which, you know, it's... which was a brilliant thing to do. And the Thatcherites should have clapped them. But you know what they did? They made it illegal because what they wanted to do was destroy a city that had a very different political stance to them. And, I mean, this is a year I know an awful lot about because I literally wrote the book about it. It's called I Don't Know Where It Is, But I Love It. It's about the 1983-84 season. And but you cannot write about Liverpool Football Club without writing about politics and writing about the social situation. One of the greatest days of my life was the Saturday before the League Cup final. Being on the train going to London. And like everyone was wearing... like red and blue ski hats, often, you know, Celtic Rangers at the time. But everyone had the I Support Liverpool City Council badges on. And when we got off at Euston, it's like the chant of Merseyside, na-na-na. And I stood there and I felt 10 foot tall with pride. You know, it was like, it was just one of the best things in the world. A city united and saying, screw you. We're going to fight for justice. We're going to fight for decency. And well, football at that point didn't come into it. The next day when the match came, obviously, you know, we ate at the Blues. But on that day, on that Saturday, it was just such a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, I mean, when you think, Pete, at the start of the 1984 year, and in Christmas 1983, Everton played a home game against Coventry City at Goodison, and the game ended in a 0-0 draw. The attendance that day was 13,000. There was a backdrop of Evertonians wanting Howard Kendall to be sacked, and there was leaflets getting given out saying, you know, 30,000 stay away fans can't be wrong. Kendall out. So, you know, for Everton, you know, the year didn't start off in a very confident manner, did it? But as the year went on, they seemed to galvanise themselves and ended up with the trophy.
I mean, you can see, if you look back, I know we're talking about 84 and the final, but if you look back to the cup run that we had, the early games, we played Brentford and Fulham in the first couple of rounds. And on both occasions, Brentford got more people at Griffin Park than we had at Anfield. And we only got a gate of just over 9,000 for the Brentford game. Admittedly, we were winning already 4-1 from the first leg. And then the third round when we drew Fulham was the time the youngsters won't appreciate this today, but it actually went to two replays. You didn't have things like extra time and penalties. And the first game was this Craven Cottage and they got 20,000 plus. And the second replay was at Craven Cottage. And once again, there was 20,000 plus. For the home game, which was the first replay at Anfield, there was just under 16,000. And it was just symptomatic of what, like Tony's mentioned at the times. I mean, you know, you got your grafters who could get into the games, you know, by hook or by crook. But generally, people just didn't have money to go to football matches. I mean, I class myself as pretty lucky. I started work in 1976 as a 16 going on to 17-year-old. And in all that time up until the present time now, I've only been out of work for 3 months. And I class myself as extremely lucky. But there were lots of people at that time who just couldn't afford to do stuff. I mean, it was bad enough trying to get food on the table if you had a family. As I say, I was living at home. I was a single lad. And I was lucky in that respect. But people with families, you know, they had to look and say, well, do I put like a place of food on the table for my family or do we go to the match? And like I say, you look at some of those attendances early on in the cup run. And, you know, smaller teams than us, the likes of Fulham, even Birmingham in the round after, they got more than us at St Andrews for the game, and that once again went to a replay. So it was just sad times. It was so, you know, it was so hard for people. And it's easy to say now, like, but football for both Liverpool and Evertonians, it was like a bit of an antidote, if you want. But trying to get to the games, I mean, as I say, the away games, people used to just graft the weight of away games. They'd ditch it or they'd bunk on the train or they'd do whatever they had to do to get to the games. And it was just like a release from the monotony and the humdrumness of being unemployed and the state of, you know, that Merseyside was in.
Yeah. As I said there, Tom, at the start of 84, Everton weren't in the best of state on the field or off the field with conflict between their fans, the manager, you know, the team wasn't doing very well. So if somebody would have told them at the start of 1984 that, you know, they'd get to Wembley and play in an All-Merseyside Cup final and then get back there, you know, a couple of months later and win the FA Cup, I think most Evertonians would have said you were stark raving mad, because I remember on the Two Tribes documentary that BT Sport did, there was an interview there with Peter Reid, and he actually said in that game against Coventry that I referenced it before, that when the cushions come down, because for those listeners who maybe don't know because they're not old enough to remember, when Evertonians went into the main stand at Goodison, they used to be given cushions. And if Everton sort of gave a bad performance, where you used to see the, you know, in Spain, you see the Real Madrid fans waving the white hankies or Barcelona fans doing the same. The Everton fans would sort of, you know, throw the cushions on the pitch to show the satisfaction of what they'd seen. And I think Peter Reid actually said on that programme, he said that a cushion come down. He said, and I played that bad that day, that when the cushion bounced, I miscontrolled it. So it really was, although, you know, Liverpool were champions in 1983. You know, we were under the new manager, Joe Fagan, but Everton were in a state of flux at that time. And as I say, there was discontent, wasn't there, with Howard Kendall?
Yeah, and it all changed, didn't it, on a FA Cup game or a League Cup game, where I think it was Aidan Heath, where the ball was played back while he was losing 1-0, and that it stuck in the mud, and he went on to score to equalise, and then from that they seemed to pick up momentum. Well, I think what Peter was saying about the crowds at that time was very representative of what was happening in the city, wasn't it? I think there was lots of areas who were really struggling, you know, and lots of jobs were going out all the time. So a lot of people couldn't get to the match. And I think that's what people said. But it was the only thing that both teams had really to keep themselves, you know, like to distract from what was going on around them. You know, as Tony talked about Tony Byrne, I knew Tony Byrne, I knew his brother Kevin as well, you know, like, and you
He was a
see,
financial genius, Tony.
he was Tony. And do you know what? Another thing, while it just sat slightly on my mind, Tony Mullane as well. Tony was a cracking fella. I knew Tony Mullane really well, and his wife Maureen, cracking fella. A man of great principle. He really was. And before, you know, like fighting for all the things. But on the football side, I think it was good that Everton started to pick up, because that motivated the city, didn't it? United the city. And so both sides at that stage started to pick up, and then we started to look forward. And it was good to see Everton from struggling.
Yeah, it was. Les, can I just talk for a moment about Two Tribes, the documentary? Because the people who made that approached me about a year beforehand, and my book, Two Tribes, I just put it in, finished to be printed. And they were talking to me about doing a documentary about Liverpool, which didn't involve football at the time. So I said, no, it's got to involve football. So I give them the manuscript of Two Tribes. And they spoke to everyone I had in the book and they cut me out of it. I got
Are
no
you
credit for
joking?
it. They used the same name. They cut me out of it completely. So I look at that and I just think gobshitery on a big scale. And the interesting thing, if I can come back to Everton after I've had a rant about people who've shafted me, come back to Everton. The first Sunday football game live on television in this country was Liverpool Everton in November 1983, 3-0 victory. We're 2 o'clock kickoff. Remember vividly, we're 3-0 up. And like the whole crowd singing Howard Kendall, there's a taxi at the gate. That night, someone sprayed Kendall out on his garage in Formby. You know, outrageous that they do that. And the interesting thing about that is that on that day, Graham Sharp got injured. So they needed to buy another striker. And Kendall was right on the edge. And he wanted Paul Mariner. And Mariner was too expensive. They couldn't afford Mariner, so they went in for Andy Gray, whose knees were screwed, being one of the first million-pound players, but his knees were screwed. But they bought Andy Gray, and Gray made the difference to them. He transformed them, his mentality, his attitude, the fact that, and suddenly they kicked on, and all the good players that Kendall had began to develop and buy into and like w one of the as I say, the interesting things, I've spoken a lot to Peter Reid about that. None of the Everton players want to talk about 83, 84. No, I'll go back. They're quite happy to talk about 83, 84. They don't want to talk about 85, 86. But like they all say, every one of them says that Andy Gray made the difference. And suddenly they went from being, frankly, relegation material in that November to challenging us in the League Cup. And while the game at Wembley was flat, dead, rained all day, the game at Main Road, the replay, that was one of the great battles. You know, people these days want goals. They think goals make football. I'll tell you what, attritional battles in the mud are far more fun.
Yeah, that's very true, that isn't it, Pete? It doesn't have to be like a 3-2 game, a 5-4 game, or a 4-3 game to have a really good game of football. As we know from the number of years that we've been watching, not just the Reds, but just football in general, that you can get a really good game that's 0-0 or 1-0. You know what I mean? And if you've got two really good teams going hammer and tong for it, you know, you really do get your entertainment, don't you? But
yeah.
But as I say, Liverpool were, I wouldn't say we're in transition, but everybody was wondering, weren't they, how Liverpool would cope under Joe Fagan. As it, you know, he was in his first season, wasn't it? You know, as Liverpool manager. And, you know, after the great success that Bob Paisley has had, people looking and thinking, you know, this could be the beginning of the end with Joe in charge. And ultimately, you know, they couldn't have been more wrong. But it was a little bit, we were a little bit into the unknown, weren't we, with Joe as a manager, because he'd had great success as part of the coaching staff. But you never know how people are going to step up the ladder.
Yeah, I mean, it was similar in ways to when the great Bill Shankly retired and then Bob Paisley came in, and we all saw him as just someone who wore a tracksuit in the dugout. You know, is he going to carry on, you know, being as great as Shanks was? But it's that continuity thing, isn't it, where they all know the Liverpool way of playing, but it's always like a little worry on your mind, I suppose. Will the incoming manager, will he be able to, you know, to carry on the mantle if he wants? But it is like a leap into the unknown. As I say, you used to look at the likes of Bob Paisley and Joe Fagan, and all you'd see them as their tracksuits. They gee the players up, they train the players, coach the players, whatever you want to say. And, you know, you think, are they up for it to manage it? But it was just the continuity that Liverpool had at the time. And whoever was not necessarily next in line, because I think they skipped one when Kenny became manager. They skipped the beat, if you want, to make Kenny play a manager. But you just wonder if the new incoming manager will get the same respect off the players, if you want, if the players will play for them in the same way. As I say, you know, you start the season and you think, I wonder how we're going to get on. And then, you know, in 8-9 months' time, suddenly you're in a European Cup final and you're winning trophies again, you know.
Well, I think what was really important is that, you know, they all loved Joe. And, you know, he come to it new. He was 63 years old. And, you know, your first season as a manager, 63. Souness gathered the players together before, you know, once it was announced, gathered them together and said, none of you bastards better let down Joe. Champagne Shirley warned them all. And when you think he had Souness, obviously he had Dalglish and he had Hansen, he had leaders there. And of course, the greatest leader of them all was Souness. And Souness really said, anyone who lets Joe down is going to have to deal with me.
Do you know, it's funny what you should say there, Tom. We had Graeme Souness on the podcast, Les, didn't we?
Yeah.
Earlier in the season. And he talked about Joe. And he talked about that. He talked about that period. And
he loved him.
He certainly did, yeah. He certainly did. And he talked about Joe and what he meant to the club and about, you know, about when he first come in and Joe was the first person to make a comment to him, and which was a funny comment, about asking him what he wanted, how he wanted him to play, which Graeme told us. But like, I think that is very true. As soon as at that time was probably one of the greatest players that you'd ever seen in the midfield. As you were talking about, funny enough, about the going back to the replay when Liverpool, you know, like when Liverpool turned up and absolutely, you know, like, it was a war, that game, because it was probably, you talk about a battle of attrition between two really quality midfields, probably the best two midfields at that time, you know, playing. in the league. And I thought he was the difference. And like as Les said, they weren't gonna let Joe down. You know, they wanted to win many trophies for Joe. So yeah. Sears was the man.
It's interesting. I had big issues with Souness, obviously, for the Sun on the third anniversary. And I was so angry with him, and I've written loads of things over the years. And when I was writing the book on 84, I obviously needed to speak to him on it. And like I went out with Kenny, and we went out for lunch in a Gordon Ramsay place. And like just after he'd been sacked, and you know what he said to me? He said, "Like, I hope you're picking up the bill." He said, "Because I'm on the dole." I'm like, Kenny, you know that's typical Kenny. But anyway, he said to me, "Charlie's looking for you," and I'm like, "Is he now?" And he went, "Yeah, he doesn't like what you're saying about him, what you're writing about him." I said, "You tell him." I said, "There's football nerd and there's real world nerd." I said, and Kenny's like, "I want to be a fly on the wall when you get together." So anyway, I approached him. You know, I texted him, said, like, "Will you talk to me, for the 84 book?" And like, so I'm like sitting there one day and the phone goes, pick it up and I go, "Hello." He goes, "That's Tony Evans." I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "It's Graham." And I'm like, Graham. How do I know Graham? He says, "Souness." And I'm like, nearly dropped the phone. So he said, "You want to talk to me?" I said, "Yeah, about 84. And he said, like, "Okay, right. I know you've got issues with me." I said, "Well, this is different." I said, "What I want to do is I want to see you. I want to write about you through the eyes of a 23-year-old. I don't want to write about you in terms of what happens afterwards." I said, "The cutoff for me in this book is after the European Cup final, when you leave in 84. And he went, "All right, I can live with that." And he gave me loads of time. He was brilliant. He told me stories. He told me stories about, Dinamo Bucharest breaking the their captain's jaw. He told me about Rome. He gave me stuff that no one has ever, written before. When at Stoke, when we got beat, around Easter, when he punched through where he thought he punched where he thought it was wall and it was glass, and he scared the secretary at Stoke, the girl who was sitting there writing in the office, and he had to write a letter of apology for it. He told me all kinds of stuff and he was brilliant. And at the end, I said to him, "Thank you, this is brilliant." And he goes, "Well, we need to talk about the elephant in the room, don't we?" And I'm like, "Oh, here we go. And he said, "Look, I'm a man who regrets nothing." And I'm like, All right. And he went, "But there's one thing I'd do different in my life." I was like, I nearly dropped the phone. Champagne Shirley's apologized in his own way. And you know what? What he did was, I'm going to say unforgivable, almost unforgivable. But I think his level of repentance is so much, and he gave so much to the club. I think we need to rehabilitate him as one of the legends of the club. And certainly, I'd put him in the top three players I've ever seen playing for Liverpool Football Club. If Joe wasn't a natural manager, he had the best captain that he could have had. And that was the combination of the two of them drove that season, and what a season.
Yeah, that's right, Tom, isn't it? When we held that, just talking about Graham now, when we held that dinner in aid at the Deborah Foundation to raise money for his charity, and he come along on that night, the welcome he got from the Liverpool supporters was just a sight to behold, wasn't it?
Oh, unbelievable. We've done an awful lot of work with Graham. So I'll tell you the story. The story is too long, but what's it called? I'll tell you the story about Graham Souness and how we went. That's how we got him on the podcast. It's a fascinating story. But I totally agree. He was brilliant when he came. It's the thing that he regretted. we've had many conversations, haven't we, Les, with him over, and many times when we first got him on a Zoom meeting years ago to bring him to sort of bring him back into the fold. And that was what we were aiming to do with the Deborah Foundation, and that's the way it come. But I love him to bits. As you said, he's a totally different human being from what you perceive. I remember Graeme Souness as a footballer, and I remember just a beast, but not just a beast. He was a beast, but with the skills of probably the greatest players in Wales football. So that's the mentality that you get from him. But you know, I think he's just a fabulous, fabulous player.
To me, 83-84 was his season. It was the he was the difference. I mean, you know, obviously we look at the whole year and we go Kenny, who is, you know, just a wonderful player and a wonderful human being. But like, I'll tell you, that year was Charlie's, and I refuse to. You know, he lets me call him Charlie, so I refuse to. And all the players call him Champagne Charlie, and we all remember where that comes from, don't we? It's there was a game at Anfield, I think it was in 82 or 83, when they substituted when Paisley substituted Craig Johnson, and the whole cop got the ump over it and was like,
it was booing. Against the Forest, wasn't it, Tony, if I remember rightly?
I think it was, yeah. And like and afterwards, Paisley, who could be a bit of a prick, frankly, said, they're all a bunch of layabouts who've never done a day's work in their life. And you know what? He says, and as for the players, they're all like Playboys and Champagne Charlies, and the whole dressing room like pointed at Souness and went, Champagne Charlie, and he was Charlie forever after.
So Pete, so as the competition progresses, Liverpool get to the semi-final, and you know, you go to the game at Walsall and the wall collapses, doesn't it, in the away leg?
Yeah, I mean, the first, just to start off, the first leg, it was at Anfield. I think Walsall would have been in the third tier, third division them days. And they got a creditable 2-2 draw. I think we went ahead in about the 75th minute. Ronnie Whelan got both goals for us, and then they went straight down the other end, and I think Alan Buckley equalised.
Winger roasted Alan Kennedy.
Yeah. It was, that's what I mean. It was no fluke. I mean, he brought a few thousand up with them, because really it was their big day out to come to like a, what was a first division ground then, not a Premier League, first division ground. Once again, the total gate was only just over 31,000. But yeah, it ended up 2-2. So we were always going to go the second leg, and we got a couple of hours off work, and we went down to Walsall on one of the specials. I think maybe two or three train loads went down that night, plus numerous coaches and other ways. And it's thingy to say now, but I remember getting into the ground, and we were standing right at the back. We were on like an open-end terrace, and we were standing at the back, and a few lads were sitting on the wall. It was like a wall at the back. And my mate said, I wouldn't sit there, mate. He said, that wall's a bit dodgy. And whether he had foresight or something, but the wall at the front actually collapsed. And there was a famous photograph, I think, where Champagne Charlie, I shouldn't call him that, because I don't know him. And he picked up a couple of the kids up. And thankfully, there was no real, I don't think there was any major injuries. But it obviously put the game, you know, the game was suspended for a while, so the police and the stewards sort of got everything sorted again. So we didn't get back into Lime Street till way after midnight. We were on about the second or third train back. By the way, we won the game 2-0. I think Ian Rush scored an early goal, and once again, Ronnie Whelan scored to see us through to Wembley.
Well, so, I remember about that night. I was round on the side. You know, just like not behind the goal, but just like probably about 10, 15 yards. And the wall collapsed, I say. And Souness come over and picked up the kid. He was the first one there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's his character. And like I was standing there, and they were singing as they lay on the battlefield, as he lay on the battlefield. I'm going, it's probably not the song to sing now, like boys. Just you know, no, no, not now.
Yeah, but as I say, we got back to Lyme way after midnight. So we lived on, like, I'm from the Whittle side, so I had to get a taxi back. And I'd left my car at my mate's house in Birkenhead in the town centre. And by the time we got back, it must have been about -2 or -3. It was absolutely freezing.
Yeah, it was a cold night, that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Get to the car, and the battery's flat, just wouldn't start. So where my mate lived, if you pushed it about 20, 30 yards, there was a road off the main road where he lived that sort of went down into Birkenhead. So I thought, right, if I get it to there, I can jump start it. Anyway, me and my mate are pushing this car at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And next thing we feel a pat on the back, and it's a copper. What are you doing? What are, he thought we were stealing the car, you know. And we said, oh, we've just come back from Walsall. I said, we've been to West Liverpool. Oh, he said there was a bit of trouble, wasn't there? You know, not trouble, but there was a bit of shenanigans and stuff. And I said, yeah, blah, blah. I said, I think everyone's all right. Anyway, this copper actually gave us a bump start. He helped us start the car in the end. But yeah, it was, I think going down to Walsall, I don't think we ever feared we'd get knocked out. I just think the consensus was we made hard work of that. But in fairness to them, they came up to Anfield and they gave a good account of themselves.
Yeah, they did, Tom, didn't they? They gave us a little bit of a fright that night. And I think it was probably a game where we all went the game thinking it was going to be a foregone conclusion, as it wasn't. And, you know, but all was over two legs. You were confident, weren't you, that Liverpool were always going to come through and reach Wembley. And then obviously then, you know, we find out they were playing against, you know, our near neighbours at Everton. And I think it was, you know, when you look back to that time now, you know, it was the excitement around the city. It gave the whole city a lift, didn't it? Both reds and blues, you know. There was a bit of a weight of being lifted off our shoulders with the, you know, the way the Tory government was treating the city, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden we had something to look forward to that was going to be unique and something just for us where we could show the world, you know, what the city of Liverpool meant to us all.
I think, yeah, going down on the coaches, they were mixed coaches, weren't they? That was things that you don't see in the modern game, you know, like the coaches mixed all the way down, all at the ground, the trains and everything. It was like a party atmosphere because, as you said, I think it showed the city as united because at that period, we were getting battered as a city. And really battered as a city. And so we went down there with unified to show that we were a united city until we got to the football match. But I thought the football match itself was a bit of a damn squib, really, wasn't it, as a game? I can vaguely remember. I can't remember too much about the game, really. I remember more about the occasion rather than the game. I know Alan Hansen, but the Evertonians always say that Hansen handled the ball. Well, you know, we'll have to leave that one for VAR, I think.
Love us.
I think you see there, Tom.
Well,
I mean, I've already, you know, said how important it was to me that weekend and that time. And, like, what people find it really hard to understand, both, you know, on both sides of the divide in Liverpool, is how much people, and I'm 63 years old, right? So it's, you know, how much interaction was. Before I started going to away games, I would go to Everton home games because it was cheap. And, you know, it was like, I go in the park and never wanted them to win, was always never wanted them to lose particularly, but was always amused when they lost, you know, one of them, and always wanted us to. And then once started going to away games, obviously, once we got into the 80s, and, you know, we're talking about this season where the first Sunday game was Liverpool and Everton, but they started playing on Fridays and Sundays, so often we didn't play at the same time. And you know what? I had Evertonian mates. I have Evertonian mates for me sins. And I go the away games with them. I've been to Old Trafford more times with Everton than most Evertonians that will exist. You know, I was there with them in 78 when, we won't go into that, when their behaviour was caused a bit of a ruckus. You know, I've been loads of times. No, I've been a few times to Old Trafford with Everton, and I used to just go with them. You know, we used to be mates and go together. When we weren't playing, we'd go to Everton. Oh, it's football. It's a laugh. You know, at that time, you know, in the mid-80s, if we didn't have a game on the Saturday, my mates would phone me on Saturday morning and like say to me, have a look in the mirror, see what the fixtures are. You know, where do you think we could go to for a game? You know, because we just love football, relatively cheap. The trains were relatively cheap before the Tories screwed that up. You know, you could do that. And like, so going to Wembley for that weekend, there was a great sense of togetherness. I always remember the Londoners looking at us in shock that there was blues and reds together. Oh my God, what's wrong with these people? And they're angry at each other. And we weren't in those days. We were angry at the fucking Tories.
Yeah, that's right. It's just funny what Tony was saying then. I was just thinking back. You know, like the amount of times as Liverpoolians and Evertonians, as I was saying to you before, we come from Speke. And Speke is like, it's a strange place. It's an island. There's nothing around it. It's not attached to anything. It's like a little island. And the groups, I've got loads of mates who are Evertonians, and Degsy Daly, Stegianassi, all, you know, like Colin McCoy, loads and loads of blues who go down. And when we met down in there over the years, we used to meet in a pub in Finchley. I think, I can't remember if it was called the White, was it the White Star? But the fella who used to run the pub was a Scouser from Spree. And like, so that was normal behaviour, as you said, in them times. So you'd meet up with them, you'd give them loads. I remember one time he took one of the lads, it was never told, took his shoe off and threw it on top of the pump, you know, where the dogs were, and left him up and we were on the what's it called. But that was, they were your mates, weren't they, at that time? And everybody was more or less in the same boat. So like, Football at that period where we were, that's mainly what we had. And like, that final did unite the two sides, really, and the city.
The worst thing that for me that's happened to football, you can talk about VAR, you can talk about, like, you know, the corporatization. That the worst thing that's happened to football for me is Liverpool and Everton hating each other. Really, yeah. Really distresses me.
Yeah. Peter, really? You know, as Tony said there, you know, it has really gone, you know, so far the other way from how it was in 1984. You know, when, you know, I went down to Wembley that year with my mates on the footy special from Lime Street to good old Wembley Central. And I just remember one of the, and it's still today one of the best sights you'll ever see. You got to Lime Street to maybe 7 o'clock in the morning to queue up for your train. And you were queuing up, and there was just reds and blues together. And you'd get on the train, and you'd be sat at one table with your red mates, and across the other table, there'd be others with blue. And it was just superb banter between the two sets of supporters. No sign of any trouble. There was not likely to be any trouble. People would take the piss out of each other, and maybe tell a few jokes about Liverpool players, or we'd never get in our team, and, you know, he's better than him, and you know what I mean? But it was all good-natured. There was nothing sinister about it. And, you know, the same coming back after the game, you know, you get back on the train, you know, we drew the game, so everybody was just made up about the day, you know, it had gone really well. So how did you get down there, Pete?
So we, There was a lad in work. I worked in a factory in Birkenhead at the time. And there was a lad in work. He was a blue. And believe it or not, he was around our age, early 20s, and he was teetotal, Gary Edwards. And he said, "Look, lads," he said, I'm thinking of getting like a minibus up or a van, you know, a hire van." Said, "If you can get a few lads in, you know, it'll be a good way of getting down there." So he got a few of us from work to join. And it was on the Sunday, the game. So we meet in Birkenhead, in one of the pubs in Birkenhead Town Centre. And next thing, there's about half a dozen lads already in the van. It wasn't a minibus, it was a van. So we were all sort of sliding around in the back. And they came from the Ford Estate. Gary lived on the Ford Estate. And
He was.
at that time, I mean, it's been renamed now, it's got a posh name, but the Ford Estate was a little bit notorious. So we sort of looked over. I didn't know. They were Gary's mates and that. But anyway, we got in. We, you know, reds and blues, like you say, mixed together. No, not nothing going on. And by the time we got to the M53, the exotic cigarettes were coming out. So we were all in. I mean, because he didn't drink anyway, Gary. So he was saying, you know, you can all have a bevy in the back. So, and as I say, the Moroccan Woodbines were coming out, and the airs hanging, and I never smoked. I've never smoked, and I think I was high by the time we got down to Kiel, you know. But we stopped at one of the services. This is on the Saturday, mind you. So we haven't even got a clue where we're staying overnight. We're just going down there for the crack. And we get out at one of the services to go to the loo and that. And one of the lads is missing. This lad Waller, missing. And we got back, and he says, "Anyone seen Waller? You can't leave him. Where's he gone?" So we have a little hunt for Waller now. And one of the lads says, "Come over here, come and see this." And over in the further from where the van was in the car park, there was this like transit van, but it was towing a small yacht. And Waller's on the yacht. He's climbed onto it at I'll call it the steering wheel, because I'm not a sailor, I don't know what you call it. And he's singing, he's giving everyone a rendition of "We Are Sailing" by Rod Stewart. There's about 300 lads and from the services looking at this fella, giving honest to God. But what a weekend. We ended up going to Scratchwood services to try and get our heads down, and the police wouldn't let us stay. We weren't the only ones. He said, "You can't stay here, lads. You can't stay overnight." So we come out to Scratchwood. We found a pub somewhere in this little village, went there till closing time, and we just ended up sleeping in the transit van. And then we went down to, you know, to Wembley, obviously, for the game. But I don't think any of us got any sleep for two full days. But we had a great
Yeah.
laugh. And like you say, it was reds and blues. There was a bit of piss taking going on. But you looked after one another as well. You know, we were going into places we'd not been before. When we walked into this pub, it was just like a little country pub, and they were amazed to see us all walking in. And them days, everyone wore the colours as well. And you know, some would have like these, like you say, the half and half hats on, Celtic or Rangers with Liverpool. Everton did the same. Or they had like the little, you know, like the jockey caps, blue and white and red and white. And they were amazed that we were all sitting together having a drink, you know.
Yeah, we went to Argyle Square, King's Cross, where seven quid over, you know, for a bed. I wouldn't say for a room, because there was like about eight of us in, you know, in the same room, and there was needles everywhere at the time. It was really, really rough, King's Cross, you know, prostitutes and all that. And like in the madness of the night before, everyone got split up, you know, one of them. So we go back to the We go back to the room and all that, and we'd lost some of my mates. And somehow, in this chaos, the most mild-mannered, non-dodgy, you know, sort of the one who's least likely to be a thief, got like sort of hooked up with a gang of fellas we knew who were bad robbers, and they broke into a Porsche, and like he come away with a thing of cassettes, you know, like a case of cassettes. And like he come into the Argyle Square, and everyone's hanging out of the windows, because like, you know, they're like, they've got you like 7, 8 to a room, and everyone's like, you know, trying to get air. He walks in, and someone shouts at him, "Have you got ciggies there, mate?" And he goes, "No, swag." And I'm like, "Oh my God, you know, it was like fucking it. It was one of those like really surreal instances. But it, like, and again, earlier on, we were in the Burger King at like Victoria, and at like about like 10, 15 Londoners come in and started like going, you know, come on, Scouse. And I'm like, oh God, don't be stupid. So like there was a big square up outside, like a dickhead. I go out to try and like calm it down. I'm like, boys, come on, we're just here for a good time. And this like Londoner's like taking off his belt, stud belt, and he's swinging it. And I'm like, oh, behave yourself, you dickhead. Put it back on. We don't want any trouble. He put it back on, and about 15 people jumped on him as the minute he put it back on. I'm like, oh, honestly, I've made a mistake here. I'm just going to go to bed. I was like, the whole madness of the whole time was brilliant. And, you know, oh, no, I'm not saying it was brilliant that some fella got kicked all over the street, but he was looking to cause trouble. But Liverpool and Everton fans were not fighting with each other. They had a common enemy on people who were being aggressive towards us. But more importantly, it was the philosophical enemy of the government, what Thatcherism was doing to us. And I think, to me, it was the peak. No, not the peak, not the peak, because Wembley in 86 was the peak of the togetherness. But was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Tom, how did you get down to Wembley that year? What's your recollection?
Minibus, as always. We with the minibus. We used to, now and again, we used to get the coach, but minibus down with Lenny and all the lads, same lads that you bumped down there with all the time. You know, our Michael, Gary, and Springer, Camry, or. All jammed in the back of this I'll run down minibus with plenty to drink on the way down there.
Tom, there was no such thing as health and safety back then. What have you got? You've got all rammed in the back of a minibus. You've got Pete rolling around in the back of a transit van. You know what I mean? And if the police had stopped you, they'd have just told you and waved you on, wouldn't they?
Do you know what one of the best things I remember was when we talk about 76 going down, you know, when we went down to Wolves, and Lenny worked for this company. It used to be like an outlet. They dug the roads and everything and done all kinds of things. They were called Ryan's, and he was Lenny Ryan. But like, and all it was like his old work fan. Now and again, he'd take some of the tools out, but like, you'd be stuck in the back of this van, and like it didn't matter when we were going down, like with Mick Beasley and his dad and his brother and all the, like Michael and everyone. He just filled the van. And we went. That was it. You just went. You had a bottle where we peed into a bottle and emptied it out. It was just chaos, you know. Well, we had great times, didn't we? I think when you talk about Tony, it's the camaraderie, isn't it? If you're being with your mates and just being with the people that are very similar to yourself, all on the same way. You belong to a collective. The collective was Liverpool Football Club. We were all Liverpudlians. We all believed in the same thing. And it was just a great time to be a supporter of football.
They were some of the best aways when you just piled into the back of a van. Honest to God. We actually went one year in a bit of comfort. We did actually manage to get a minibus rather than a transit van. And we had this big flag out the window, and my mates had painted on it. It was actually a Union Jack, which you don't see anywhere on the cop or anywhere these days, but it was a Union Jack, and it had the A team on it. And it was hanging out the window, and we got pulled up going into Stoke by this copper. So he says to the it was Gary again who drove down, even though he was an Evertonian. Gary drove for us, and he wound the window down. He said, "Are you going to match, lads?" And my mate shouts in the back, "Bloody hell, he's CID material. He's clever, this fella, isn't he? You know, we've got Liverpool scarves and banners hanging out the window." And anyway, we started having a bit of a laugh with the coppers. They were saying, "We've got to hold you here till a few more of your coaches and that come, and we'll escort you in." And my mate shouts in the back, to this cop, and he said, "Listen, don't wind that driver up. He's a bastard when he's had a bevy, you know." And it just went that over the cop's head. It just didn't register at all. We're all in the back half bevy, like taking the rip. But they were some of the best days, then, I tell you.
Yeah, it was a great. As I say, when you look back, Tony, on 1984, it was all about the occasion, and you know, the more you take a look back, the more you think that the draw at Wembley, although it was a real dour game, and you said before it was more about the occasion, it was though it had to end that way, so the people of Liverpool and Merseyside could show the rest of the country that, and put two fingers up to the establishment and Thatcherism, and start singing Merseyside, Merseyside, as the players did the lap of honour at the end of the final. And then you see Liverpool players with Everton scarves on, Everton players with Liverpool hats on, and that photograph that was taken on the pitch of the two teams together. And it just showed you didn't need that, you know, you might want to kick us, but you're never going to knock us down.
You know, I wish it was the same today. I think, and it's really disappointing for me, because we are the same people. We are on the same side. I get a lot of abuse from Evertonians on social media, because like they just assume red shite. The reality is that during the 2000s, when, you know, the club was being run by Philip Green, not one blue journalist called that out. I wrote about it to the point that I got legal letters that I had to talk to Philip Green. You know what? I care about them because they're neighbours where I have family who are Evertonians. They don't care about Man United. Yeah, I might have friends who are Man United, but I don't have family who are Man United. I didn't grow up around them. You know, so they're the enemy. Everton are not the enemy. You know, I wish I wish it was the same as then, where we respected each other, we were on the same side. And you know what? I never want Everton to finish above us. I don't mind them finishing behind us. They can be successful like they were in those days. And I was quite happy about it. But you know what? Those are great days, because the city was together. Everyone was on the same page, and everyone knew what the common enemy is. And I'll tell you what, if you think Everton are the enemy, or if you're an Evertonian and you think Liverpool are the enemy, then you're deluded.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, Michael always still says this today, you know, Tom. He listens to this podcast during the week. My brother-in-law, my closest friend, you know, like, and he says that to me, you know, like, even today, he still, out of everyone, he's the one who always says he doesn't have any bad feelings for Everton. My old man was an Evertonian. Peter's old man was an Evertonian. It's like, I've got loads of family who are Evertonians, you know, like.
Well, I'm from Scotty, which was predominantly blue when I grew up.
Yeah, they, but that's by the by. You give each other stick, but you don't really mean or wish them bad. I think what it is, it's the younger generation. As you said before, like, my dad used to go and watch Liverpool one week and Everton the other. You know, like because football, he wanted to watch football.
Yeah,
my father-in-law did exactly the same.
I used to go to Tranmere on a Friday night.
Yeah. So they just love football. You know, like, and I think that's the sad. I think there's a lot of reasons. I'm reading your book at the moment, so The Two Tribes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's about 86.
84 to 86, isn't it?
85, 86. The 83-84, because I don't know where it is, but yeah. I love it. You might enjoy that, because that's much more Liverpool-focused. This one is socially and politically.
Yeah. I like this one. I really enjoyed this one. I learned some things that I didn't know. I didn't know the story about what me and Les were talking about the other day, about the bus, about
them wrecking the bus.
The money for the bus and Kendall. If he lost the game, wouldn't go on the bus behind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I'll tell you what. It was really hard to get the Blues to talk about 85, 86. But, like, in the end, they were really generous. And the great people, Peter Reid, what a Scouser he is. You know, yeah. It's one of them. You look at Sharpie as a tremendous fella. And the teams mixed with each other. They drank with each other. They were best mates. They wanted to kill each other on the pitch. And then they're all going the ale together. I love it. I mean, it's how football should be and how, we'd love it to be. And I look back on it now and I think to myself, it was probably the finest time for the city, because everyone despised us, and yet we had the two best teams in Europe, and we stood up there and said screw you, and the togetherness. And of course Heysel meant that all fell apart, but what a year it was and what a game.
Pete, and this sums up football back in the day, doesn't it? We're all touching back to Merseyside after the final on the Sunday, and then there's a replay on the Wednesday. So, we've already all sorted time off work to go to Wembley, and then we're all sort of thinking, oh shit, we've got to go and try and get our tickets on Monday. Time off to finish early and for the replay at Main Road, which was on the Wednesday.
Well, we did going down on the Saturday with some savoury characters, shall I say. We didn't sleep for two nights, so we must have got back stupid o'clock in the early hours of Monday morning. I didn't have a day off work, and the next thing I know, my mum's shaking me about 11 o'clock. She said, "Have you taken the day off today?" And I said, no. She said, well, it's 11 o'clock. And I'd slept right through. I was that tired. I used to have one of those radio alarms, and the radio would come on. I just didn't hear it. So I get into work and walk in. It was just like a little shop, like a manufacturing place, a little shop floor. So around the cheers, a couple of the lads who come with us, they managed to get up. And he said, are we going to replay or what? I'm all the way back in the van. We were saying, oh, I can't be bothered going to a replay. I'm shattered. I need some time. So obviously then 5 o'clock comes and we're straight over to Anfield to get tickets again. So this time we actually went up to Manchester for the replay in my car. I drove up with a couple of other lads, well, three other lads from where three of us were Reds and a lad, Johnny Walker, was a Blue. So we had a blue and white scarf out of one window, red and white out the other, made our way up to Manchester, and we managed to just park up. Probably the last parking spec in the Prince's Pub, the big pub that was just by about a 10-minute walk from the ground. And that was, once again, full of Reds and Blues, singing the songs of one another and just getting on. And once again, I think that the local police were probably a bit worried it might go off, but it was more likely that Liverpool and Everton would stick together if any locals tried to cause any trouble. Ended up going to replay because, as we all know, it was a bit of a dodgy place to go to, Main Road. It wasn't the nicest place to go to. So I think we all found safety in numbers that night,
Yeah, Tony, as you said, if the final at Wembley was all about the occasion for Merseyside, the replay at Main Road was all about the football. Because it was a great game, wasn't it, the replay? Two teams giving it everything. Going hammer and tongue. And as you said before, it was a great goal by Suey that was the difference. But I also always remember that night that Brucey had a really good game in goal. They played a lot of high balls into the box, and Brucey was commanding his box. And for once, he come out and really caught everything. But yeah, that was a fantastic night. That to win the first All Merseyside Cup final, even though it was at Main Road, was a tremendous feeling, and was a start of the first leg of a treble.
Yeah, and what was really interesting is talking to people who were in both dressing rooms that night at half time. Both dressing rooms, the big message was, right, we've got to outfight these bastards. It's not about football, we've got to outfight them. And like Ronnie Moran and Souness rallied the Liverpool dressing room, Peter Reid and obviously Howard rallied the Everton one, and we come out and we were better than we outfought them. And what it was the it was the sort of the it was the prelude to a couple of months, a fantastic couple of months, where, to be honest, we shouldn't have won the title. It looked at times we didn't. And then we went to Rome to a game where you're playing someone at home in the European Cup final. They've got Brazilians everywhere. And never mind Istanbul. If you looked at the circumstances of Rome in 84, you'd think, It's not going to happen. But they are all other stories, and they are brilliant other stories. But that night at Main Road, at half time, when they were covered in mud, when both dressing rooms had a massive rallying cry to go out and outfight them, Liverpool went out and outfought them.
Yeah, and that was the thing, wasn't it, Tom, about that Liverpool side, with Graeme Souness, as captain on the field, there was no inch given, was there? They could outplay teams and they could outfight teams. That team would never be bullied. And once again, when it come to a fight on the pitch, they rolled the sleeves up and they showed the metal, they showed what they were made of, and got across the line.
Yeah, I think as we were talked about before, Souness led them. But you know what? Ronnie Wheeler had a great game that night. He's the one, what's it called? You look at the side, it was just, as Tony said before, it was a team full of winners and battlers and people who were never going to give in. I think really on that side, and you were looking across and you're thinking, no quarter asked and no quarter given. I think Liverpool deserved it on the night slightly, but I think it was a great game of football and won by a brilliant goal. And as Sue said earlier, he got a punch in the face from Ronnie Whelan as he was celebrating.
Yeah, as I say, what a goal, and what a goal it was to win, the first All Merseyside Cup final. On that note, we'll end this special edition of the LFC Red Port podcast. There's loads more we can talk about 1984, not just about the football, but about what happened at Orgreave and the role South Yorkshire Police played at Orgreave, which was to impact massively on Liverpool in 1989. And hopefully, over the next few months, Tony might agree to come on again and talk about the 1984 season.
Look, I'm always keen to talk about this because it's a very important period in British history, never mind Liverpool history, and perhaps it's been forgotten. So, boys, whenever you want me, and it's like I said, I wrote the book about this season and the one after that, which Orgreave has mentioned a lot. I was at Orgreave. So, I was on those picket lines, and when I was in the farm, we played all the miners' gigs. Not all of them, obviously, but plenty of them. And so I'm always willing to come on, and I've really enjoyed it tonight, boys. Thank you.
Can I just say before we go, if anyone of any of the listeners buy the book, it's a quality read, it really is. Tony, it's fantastic having you on, mate, and we look forward to having you on very again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Thank you.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, boys. Yeah. Anytime, just let me know.
Yeah, okay. So on that note, we'll end this edition of the LFC Red Poets podcast. Thanks to Tom and Pete, as always, for joining me tonight. Thanks to our special guest, Tony Evans. And as I always do, I end the podcast by saying, justice for the 97. Don't buy the sun, and you'll never walk alone. Until next time, see you soon.